If you're visiting here today, we have been going through the book of Acts for a better part of the year, beginning already in January, and we'll be concluding next week, in fact, and then moving to a summer series where we're going to look at a variety of psalms, so a summer through the psalms. That will start in July. But as we near the end of the book of Acts, we pick up the story in Acts chapter 27, and I want to invite you to turn there. We've had some sense of the narrative becoming a little bit more intense, particularly these last number of chapters. On a number of occasions, Paul has been caught up in riots that have happened in Ephesus and in Jerusalem. He's been imprisoned, as he was in Caesarea, for 2 years. He's been on trial before different Roman officials and leaders, and now, quite literally, he's in a shipwreck. And as we pay attention to this narrative, we, of course, want to hear what God is saying to us through this narrative. I'm just going to put up a map here, if I may, perhaps even as I read through the narrative, at first I wasn't planning to read through all 44 verses. It is a long section. And yet, if you can't read the scriptures in length at church, where can you read them? I think we should read the whole story. And perhaps as we read it, you might follow along exactly the journey that the ships went on. There was two of them, one that he took from Caesarea, and then to Myra on the southern coast of what we call Turkey, and then from Myra eventually to Malta, where he ends up. And you can see that journey on the map before us. Acts chapter 27, beginning at verse 1. When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, Paul and some other prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius, who belonged to the imperial regiment. We boarded a ship from Adamitum, about to sail for ports along the coast of the province of Asia, and we put out to sea. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. The next day we landed at Sidon, and Julius, in kindness to Paul, allowed him to go to his friends so that they might provide for his needs. From there we put out to the sea again and passed to the lee of Cyprus. That would be the north east part of Cyprus, because the winds were against us. When we had sailed across the open sea off the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. We made slow headway for many days and had difficulty arriving off of Cnidus. When our wind did not allow us to hold our course, we sailed to the lee of Crete, opposite Salmone. We moved along the coast with difficulty and came to a place called Fair Havens, near the town of Lycia. Much time had been lost, and sailing had already become dangerous because by now it was after the fast. So this would have been around October, middle of October. And so Paul warned them, "Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also." But the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and of the owner of the ship. Since the harbor was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. This was a harbor in Crete, facing both southwest and northwest. When a gentle south wind began to blow, they thought they had obtained what they wanted, so they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force, called the northeaster, swept down from the island. The ship was caught by storm and could not head into the wind, so we gave way to it and were driven along. As we passed to the lee of a small island called Cauda, we were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure. When the men had hoisted it aboard, they passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together, fearing that they would run aground on the sandbars of Syrtis, and on the map you can see that region just north of today's Libya, famous for being a graveyard of ships, even to this day it's known that way, they lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along. We took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day they began to throw the cargo overboard. And on the third day they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. After the men had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, "Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost, only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of God, the God whose I am and whom I serve, stood beside me and said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So, keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island.' On the 14th night, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea when about midnight the sailors sensed they were approaching land. They took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings again and found it was 90 feet deep. Fearing that they would be dashed against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight. In an attempt to escape the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea, pretending that they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. Then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, 'Unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved.' So the soldiers cut the ropes and held the lifeboat and let it fall away. Just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. For the last 14 days, he said, you've been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head. After he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all. He broke it and began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. When daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. Cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach. But the ship struck a sandbar and ran aground. The bow stuck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the surf. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. But the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were there, who got there on planks or on pieces of the ship. In this way, everyone reached land in safety." And if we were, we could read the next number of verses in chapter 28, arriving safely in Malta. Paul experienced a snake bite, people thinking it was the judgment of the gods against him being a prisoner, and he lived. Then they thought he was a god. He ended up healing the father of an official on the island called Publius, and eventually healed many on the island on account of the power of God at work in him. Many people have observed that Luke has spent considerable time in his narrative explaining all the details of this particular storm at sea. Luke has spent considerable time going through detail by detail of all that happened. Some commentators in the past thought that this was just embellished fiction, that this wasn't a real experience at all, but just embellished fiction. Perhaps it was one man in particular in the 19th century, as a number of commentators have noted, that through years of on-site research and interviews. This was a British man. He was a sailor himself. And he was so intrigued by this particular story that he wanted to research for himself whether the details of this particular story played out according to ancient ship navigating in the time of Paul. And sure enough, as he interviewed people, as he observed the weather patterns of this particular region, even sailing along the very route that it's believed Paul and the crew sailed along, he was so convinced that this was not a work of fiction, but in fact said all the details, and there are many of them, the number of anchors, the way that soundings would have been done, all the details were precisely in accordance with the kind of ships that would have sailed in Paul's day, the kind of weather pattern that was experienced in this particular trip, given the season of the year that they were sailing. All the details were such that this man confirmed, undoubtedly, this was an eyewitness account of what took place. Luke, of course, was on board. He was with Paul and the 274 others that were aboard the ship. And for many people, when they read the story of a storm and people being delivered, for many people, it's very easy to understand that the heart of the message is take courage, have faith. Believe that God is with you and everything will be okay. And I suppose in one sense, that is something we draw from a story like this. And we do so because many of us have experienced things in our own life that quite literally feel like storms. If they weren't literal storms, they certainly might feel like it. I've never experienced a storm at sea. Anyone here been on the water and experienced a nasty storm? Okay, I see about 8 or 9 hands. The worst that I can remember is once on a small turboprop plane. This was just a few months before I was finishing my career as an engineer. And I had to fly from Buttonville Airport north of Toronto to Syracuse, New York to visit one of our suppliers. And I was going with my boss. She had known already at the time that I was going to be resigning from my work to pursue a calling into the ministry, to go to seminary. She was very encouraging to me even when I told her that news. This was about 3 months before I was quitting. So nobody else knew I was going to be quitting, but my boss knew. And she was encouraging me. We had to travel together to visit this supplier. And I'll never forget the flight back. This was one of those small turboprops. Buttonville's a small airport. We probably had 15 people on board. And the turbulence as we arrived in Buttonville was rather frightening. And in those days, before 9/11, you could actually look out the front window of the plane. They didn't even have a door on the cockpit. It was a curtain, but it was open. And Terumi was sitting here in the aisle, I was sitting here, we were right at the front staring out the window, and the plane was going crazy. It was one of these landings where, you know, you would expect the plane to go straight for the runway, but we were flying like this because the wind was blowing so hard, and then by the time we hit the runway, we were all clapping, all 15 of us, because we made it. I was a little nervous, and I don't get nervous in turbulence too easily. My boss was frightened. And you know, the very first thing she said to me when we landed, she put her arm on my armrest, on my arm, and she said, "I knew we were going to be okay because God has called you to something special and he's not going to let you die." I do remember when she said that, feeling encouraged. My own boss was affirming this new call in my life, and I did have some sense, even through her words, that God took care of us. It was a little unsettling. And I think that many of us, if we haven't gone through a storm at sea or maybe even terrible turbulence on a plane, we have gone through experiences in our life that quite literally feel like storms. And so when we read a passage like this one, there is some sense in which we find encouragement and are compelled when we hear God say, "Trust me, I've got this under control." But as is always the case with Luke, and we've seen this a number of times as we've gone through the gospel, as is always the case with Luke, this is much more than just a message about have faith, be encouraged, trust God. It certainly is that. But Luke has something deeply significant to say as he narrates this particular voyage of Paul and the many others. The Jews, these were not seafaring people. And if you know the Old Testament and its stories, if you know the Psalms and the things that it says about the sea and about God's authority over the sea, you know that in the Jewish writings, these are not seafaring people. In fact, they look at the sea as representative of darkness and chaos. The god of the sea, Yom, is the god of storm and chaos. They see the sea in many ways representing evil and wickedness, a place of uncertainty, a place that God himself, when he spoke the first words of creation, he parted the sea and brought order. The Jews, they had this sense of the sea as the dwelling place of what was chaotic and wicked. Even in the Psalms, the sea is the place where Leviathan lurks, or Behemoth, the sea monster. It's only God who can bring calm to the sea, as Jesus did in the New Testament. The Jews had this sense of the sea. Even, you remember, Jonah, the story of the prophet of God who was called to go to Nineveh. He hopped on board and certainly, as he was sailing, encountered the chaos of the sea and the force of the sea god Yom that needed to be appeased. And in Jonah's story, that god, it would seem, according to the narrative, was appeased through the sacrifice of Jonah himself. Jonah knew, "Throw me overboard and the ship will be saved." You can't help but hear a little bit of that story in the story we read, and Luke is very intentional to make sure we do, and I'll say more about that in a few minutes. Luke, knowing the way in which the Jews thought about the sea, and then finding himself on this ship and experiencing all the things that he's narrated for us, recognizes that the hand of the Lord upon them and the message that the Lord is communicating through them to God's people, the church. Remember, Luke was writing this after this took place to the church. Luke knew that God had a very significant message in this particular story. We already saw a number of weeks ago the way in which Jesus' journey to Jerusalem in the Gospel of Luke has a lot to say about Paul's journey to Rome in the book of Acts. These two journey metaphors are significant. Jesus must journey to Jerusalem, the center of salvation activity, and from Jerusalem now the church journeys outward, extending the announcement of that salvation to the world. And Paul is now taking the message of the gospel quite literally to the ends of the earth, to the very center of imperial power, the city, the great city of Rome. Jesus had to journey to Jerusalem, and already in Acts chapter 19, we hear that Paul had to journey to Rome. The announcement that Paul was bringing was nothing less than the announcement of the gospel itself. In Acts chapter 1, what was the church called to do? To be my witnesses. Witnesses that Jesus Christ was God who had become king and was ruling all over history, was ruling all of history. In Acts chapter 1, that vision of Jesus ascending on the clouds and the promise that he would return again on the clouds, that vision had such theological significance for those disciples, they knew with their own eyes that Jesus was the Son of Man announced by Daniel in Daniel chapter 7 and 9. That Jesus was none other than God who had become king. Jesus was none other than the Lord of history, the Lord of creation. He was there before them, and he had given them the message to announce his kingship and the consequences of his kingship in the world. And that's what the church does. Throughout the book of Acts, we've been seeing it. We saw how it began in Jerusalem and Judea. And that imposter king, King Herod, who thought himself to be king of the Jews, you remember him. He had Peter thrown in prison in Acts chapter 12 as if he could stop the work of King Jesus. As if he could stop the work of the servants of King Jesus. Herod even thought himself to be a pagan god. You remember at the end of Acts chapter 12 where the crowd started adulating Herod as though he were a god, and he swelled up with all his bright robes and took the adulation, and God afflicted him with a terrible illness and he died. And Josephus the historian confirms that story for us. You see, as the gospel first beginning in Jerusalem and Judea, as it is announced to the Jews by the church, Herod, who would try to oppose it, thinking he was king of the Jews, Herod is brought low by God. And now the message continues from Judea and Samaria to the ends of the earth. We are in the part of the narrative where the gospel now must go right under the nose of Caesar himself, the great emperor that rules the known world. The gospel must go there too. As Jesus journeyed to Jerusalem, that was no easy journey. As Jesus journeyed to Jerusalem, and you can read about it in Luke chapter 9, 51 through to chapter 19. You can read about the way in which Jesus encountered opposition, the way in which he encountered resistance, the way in which, as he continued his journey, the Jewish rulers and chief priests intensified their plot to kill him, to silence him. And then finally, as Jesus entered into Jerusalem and there was about to accomplish for his people quite literally the means by which they and all humanity would be saved, all hell broke loose as Jesus entered into those final days of his life. He was mocked and spitten upon and beaten and whipped, given a cross. Nails were pounded through his flesh such that the powers of all the darkness in the world were mustered together, and they assailed Jesus, thinking, "We've killed him. He's dead. Caesar and the king of the Jews have triumphed." That was Jesus' journey to Jerusalem, and God vindicated Jesus. God rose Jesus from the dead. Death could not hold him. The powers of sin could not secure him. Jesus was alive. And we must not forget that journey when we read this journey of Paul. It's almost like Luke wants to superimpose that cross upon Paul's cross, if you will, his shipwreck at sea. That's not to say that in the same way that Jesus experienced crucifixion, Paul too experiences crucifixion. No, not at all. Jesus' death for sin and for securing the salvation of the world was a one-time event. But Paul will say numerous times in his gospel, "I have been crucified with Christ." Paul will speak about the way in which he carries the crucifixion with him. Paul will speak about the ways in which the church under the crucified Lord experiences sufferings and storms in which all hell tries to break loose and silence the voice of the church, in which all hell tries to break loose and derail the work of the church, derail the work of parents who are discipling their children, derail the work of families who are caring for their communities, derailing the work of those who refuse to bend the knee to the God of money, to the God of sex, to the God of power, and live for Christ alone. The forces of darkness do their utmost to derail the work of the kingdom. And Paul, as he has his set sight on Jerusalem, it is as if the forces of nature collect with the forces of the empire to try and kill Paul and all his companions. There is a sense in which the cross is superimposed on this shipwreck. In the same way that Jesus, as he journeyed to Jerusalem, experienced opposition, so too the church, as it advances towards its purpose, its mission, we too will experience the reality of suffering. In fact, if there's one thing I have learned as I've served as a pastor and become more familiar with the scriptures, I think you can say with certainty that one of the defining qualities of being a follower of Jesus Christ is suffering. The church experiences the suffering of our Lord for the sake of the world. As you and I, called by Jesus Christ, filled and empowered by His Holy Spirit, as you and I, like Peter and Paul and many others through history, go forward and embody the kingdom, bringing the message of Christ, the hope, the peace, the joy of Christ, bringing the goodness and love of Christ into the world, the church experiences suffering. There's opposition to that. There's very real powers in our world that try to derail the church from its purpose and distract them by gods that parade and offer enticements and pleasures to make us think that our lives are in part dedicated towards them. The church has always been derailed by these things. We experience the powers of the dark forces in our world assailing us. But Paul speaks a word of powerful confidence. I know that God is with me. I speak to you on behalf of the God that I belong to, and it's going to be okay. And if all those who are caught up with me in this, dare I call it an ark, all those who are caught up with me in this ark, if we together put our trust in this Jesus Christ, the captain of our souls, it's going to be okay. No matter how bad the wind is, no matter how strong the storm is, no matter how much you have been swept off your feet by whatever tragedy has come into your life, I tell you it's going to be okay. Because Jesus has risen from the dead, and He's right here in the boat with us. I told you that this story draws on the story of Jonah. No doubt, particularly as you picture the men in our narrative throwing stuff overboard, trying to lighten the ship, that harkens exactly what the sailors were doing in Jonah's day. Let's make the ship lighter. Let's try and do whatever we can to either appease the evil gods or reduce our ballast. All these things we must do, and you see the parallels there. And Jonah knew that if he was thrown overboard, because he knew his disobedience, if he was thrown overboard, the sea would grow calm. And Luke says about Jesus that Jesus is a greater Jonah in Luke chapter 11. Jesus is a greater Jonah who quite literally offered his life. He sacrificed his life for our sake. And all who put their trust in him, all whose lives are kept in his ark of salvation, their lives are secure. Jesus endured death so that we would not have to die. And Paul's faith is in this Jesus who has secured his life. Paul's faith is precisely in this God who has given him the message, we're going to be okay. And this is a message for us today. This is a message that Cynthia believed deep in her heart. My life is coming to an end. I got this terrible staph infection in my leg. The last few days, she was overcome with pneumonia. I know death is not going to win. It's going to be okay. Please pray that I might go and be with Jesus. The Christian lives with the security that Jesus is in the boat. He's the one that offered himself such that the sea could be calm again, such that the storms of life will never wash us overboard and leave us without hope. Friends, as you and I, in service of Jesus Christ, carry the gospel, we will encounter suffering. We live in a world that does whatever it can to avoid suffering, often getting intoxicated with pleasures, with entertaining distractions, even putting all kinds of money towards how do I make my life happy and entertaining. Christians know that as they serve Jesus Christ, the one who had to go to Jerusalem, as you and I serve Jesus Christ, going where God directs us, we will suffer. But Peter says, I consider it pure joy if I might suffer for the sake of my Lord. Peter, like Paul, knew in the secure hope that the church has, no storm will overtake the life of God's people. That is good news. Why? Because everybody experiences a storm in their life. And we may leave this place with the words on our hearts that we sung, do not be afraid. I am with you. And all God's people say, amen.